thank you, Dave, for that introduction. And the reason that, one of the reasons that I'm here is because I consider you all frontline communities in terms of you're where the economy and public health and the environment all come together on the grounds. And if we do it right in these frontline communities, ideally, we will have jobs that don't kill us and jobs that don't kill our environment. This is about building all forms of wealth together. And what I've seen too many times and what I'm going to be showing tonight is that all too often, the jobs come as a sacrifice of the environment and health. Health of our children, health of our elderly folks, and it doesn't need to be that way. I'm going to share kind of my story and weave it in with how I got to be here and come to the BP Whiting refinery spill. Well, it'll be woven in, all right? So this is going to be kind of storytelling, which is what I was asked to do. So I'm starting with me growing up in Wisconsin in the mid-1960s. I was the oldest of three children, and the I was a middle school student when this, well, right around when this photo was taken. And I was walking to school 67, and literally birds were falling out of the trees dying. And I'm walking to school, and I'm picking up these birds, and I'm pushing them under bushes to die. And finally one day it occurs to me to ask my dad, why is this happening? And my dad puts my hands together, picks up a dying robin, puts them in them, and I'm watching this bird's eyes dilate and constrict, and he explains about what? What was being sprayed, 60s?
DDT.
DDT, okay? And in my kid mind, my dad was a paper salesman. I thought that was pretty ordinary for a dad. But he was also, in my kid mind, I sensed that he was worried about us three kids. He wouldn't let us go running behind the DDT trucks, right? Like the other kids in the neighborhood, right? And so I thought, oh, it's killing the birds. It's got to be bad for us kids, too. This is all me, right, thinking this through. So my dad gave me the book Silent Spring, which I read the summer I turned 14. And I was amazed that a person could know so much. This is Rachel Carson's book, about something and explain it in a way that was inspiring and ordinary people like my dad could get it and then take action. And my dad sued the state of Wisconsin over the use of DDT. And this battle played out when I was in high school. We had the lawyer and the biologist roaring around, practicing their court talks and arguments. And I soaked this all in as a kid. So by 72, when the Wisconsin had banned DDT, the rest of the nation followed suit. That's when I was off to go to a college. And by then, I had decided that I really liked Rachel Carson, and I wanted to be a marine biologist. So guess what? No marine, right? So off I went. And ultimately, after 13 years of, quote, higher education. Now, that's in quotes because the real education started in a community, right? This is what I found somewhat randomly. I should explain that all my college and a graduate level courses were all woven around oil because the Torrey Canyon had wrecked in England in 1967, the same year as I was reading Rachel Carson's book. I didn't know anything about that, but that was a big oil spill, and the oil industry had not been prepared to clean up. And that shocked the international community. And laws started coming down. And I'll get into this a little bit later. Our national contingency plan passed how we were in 1968. That was a direct response to the Torrey Canyon. Well, 69, what happened on the West Coast? Santa Barbara oil spill? National contingency plan didn't work so well. So this has been a constant struggle to improve this thing. And I'll catch that story back up. With my schooling was in oil pollution research. It was on dispersants, these chemicals that are sprayed on marine oil spills to put them under the water surface. But anyway, I came to Cordova and just totally fell in love with the area. This is a little tiny bush community on the eastern shore of Prince William Sound. So The northern shore is where the Trans-Alaska Pipeline Terminus comes down. So we share our fishing grounds with the oil company. And I became a commercial fisher, ma'am, okay? And actually ran a boat in a permit, had a permit, limited entry fishing permit, was fishing salmon, drift gillnet salmon, with my partner. And, I was totally in love with everything. And 4 years, this was 1985 to 1988. 1988, March 24th, 1989, got the knock on the door. We've had the big one. And I was the second plane to fly out over the wreck of the Exxon Valdez. It was literally like this big. It's 3 football fields long of a tanker. We're flying over it, and all you see is oil everywhere. There's 2 tankers here. One is lightering what remained on the bottom in that boat. It was carrying 55 million gallons total. 8 of 11 cargo holds were ripped wide open. And the industry always downplays what it spilled, because what it spilled is what it gets fined on. And if nobody can prove that a higher amount spilled, they get the lowest number for their fine. So the industry maintains 11 million gallons. The state of Alaska did an investigation, but settled. But I got the papers, and the papers show probably 30 to 35 million gallons. It was a lot of oil. It was a big frickin' mess. And I won't go into too many stories. I mean, literally, we had no boom, none of the promised cleanup equipment, and the fishermen are not people to sit around, okay? So in their boats they go, and the next thing I know, the guys are scooping up in 5-gallon buckets more oil than Exxon was collecting when it finally got its skimmer out there. It was just a total... Anyway, lots of stories there, okay? So we're going to fast forward to what happened to the wildlife and then to the people. And because these are lessons that I carry forward now. And what happened was this oil got pushed into all the little nursery, the bays and the coves that are the nursery for the pink salmon and the young of the year crab and the herring and the little halibut babies. It's like a nursery instead of being in the open ocean. And the oil was jammed in there. And the oil company said, oh, there won't be any long-term damage. And actually, the federal government said the same thing. And the fishermen all came to me and said, why did they say that? And I said, well, because science is a kind of a moving target. And when the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act were passed in the 1970s, that was the state of science. The state of science only focused on the stuff that evaporates quickly into the air, dissolves quickly into the water. So like the gas stations now, you know, when you fuel your car with gas, they have the shields. Well, can you remember what the air smelled like before that? When you were fueling up, kind of sweet smelling? That's all like benzene and volatile organic compounds that are in oil. But they evaporate really quickly. Well, that's what our laws are passed on. What about the black stuff that stays on the beaches? The fishermen asked me. I said, I don't know. Okay? But I don't think it's going to be so good. So, sure enough, a lot of the young of the year, pink salmon and herring that were in the swath of oil that left Prince William Sound, those beaches were decimated. And it was enough to completely collapse the ecosystem in 1993. So like all the young of the herring babies, they're babies for 4 years. So 1989 plus 4, no baby herrings really showed up. And these are things that they hold the whole ecosystem together. So if the herring go down, everything goes down. And to this day, we still do not have a herring fishery in Prince William Sound. It wiped it out. We are talking 25 years now. And these are guys that had $300,000 permits that they owed an annual permit payment on, like a house. And that permit payment was paid by fishing. And they can't fish. So they had to scavenge their kids' college. I mean, this went on for 20 years, our lawsuit. We thought we were going to get paid. But it turns out no, because the science at the time didn't support long-term harm from oil. So what we did was, and this is about power, and it's about, I think it was Cesar Chavez that said, you know, power is the ability to act, basically. And we forget that. We think that power is somebody we elect for Congress or somebody we elect for state or But we have power to act as well. And that's sort of the theme of this. So what we did was we collectively took our fishing boats in August of 1993, and we blockaded Valdez Narrows, which is a bottleneck that the tankers have to come through from the open ocean to get into Port Valdez. All right? We blockaded it. And this was before, of course, 9/11. But still at the time was 25% of the nation's domestic oil. We had a different president. We had the oil companies telling us, Exxon telling us, we're fine. We hadn't even gone to court yet. That was 1994. We had no fish. So how are we supposed to make a living, right? And when the President Clinton sent in his Bruce Babbitt secretary to talk to us, by the way, before I get there, let me just say that when the town of Cordova heard what our fishermen were doing, we used all our little boats, our gillnet boats, to run the women and the children out. So this is like the town of Cordova, 2,500 people, not everybody, but I mean, there's women and children. The Department of Energy had called the armed gunboats coming up from Seattle to break up this up. But it would take 4 days, and we knew that, so we held for three. And by then, Clinton had sent in Babbitt, and Babbitt said, the order was find out what that bunch of fishermen wants. And Babbitt was really surprised to find that the fishermen were asking for science, because we felt we knew what had happened. We felt that it was the story was in the eggs and the embryos and the juveniles, and nobody was looking at that. And because the fishermen did this, there was a decade of studies that now is established science that proves that oil is more hazardous than we thought. It's this ultrafine particles, also known as soot, also known as polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, or PAHs. And this gets inside our cell membranes. When I say our, I mean people as well. But things with the backbone, so birds, fish, mammals. And it jams cell function. So it jams reproductive function, for example. It's an endocrine disruptor. It jams immune system function, so you're sick and all the time. It jams respiration, formation of enzymes that are necessary to hold the oxygen when we take a breath and pull that oxygen through our blood. I mean, it goes on and on. It jams DNA. And it's not just in the organisms that are exposed. It's in their offspring and their offspring's offspring. Six generations it was logged with pink salmon. It took 10 years for pink salmon to recover, and the herring haven't still. And, oh, it was published in Science magazine. So I think before I go here, I just want to say that at the same time as the wildlife science was happening, there was also studies that were being done in the medical community completely separately, identifying the same thing, that these PAHs, these ultrafine particles, are a problem. They're a problem for people. Exact same problems that I talked about. So, in wildlife. Okay, so. Hang on. So here's our community. Imagine a fishing community with no fish. We had our fall 2008 in August of 1993 is what it boiled down to. And when the fishermen came back, there was something very empowering about taking collective action like that. We all wanted no fines for civil disobedience. But the feeling of empowerment, people's attitudes changed. When they came back to town that fall, there was the can-do attitude back again. And it's like our worst fear had happened. So that's a very liberating thing. You have nothing more to fear. You have nothing more to lose. You just lost it all. Now you can get creative. What are we going to do to right our town? And people took off with different ideas. I will say that with the financial stress, the way it manifested in our town was increased violence, increased suicide, increased divorces, increased substance abuse. I mean, it got really, really ugly. There was a team of scientists that came up, ironically, from the University of South Alabama, Dr. Steve Picou, and then from Mississippi. And we Cordova community, is the longest running case study on disaster trauma anywhere on this planet right now. We were studied for 21 years, and it's really, those are other stories. But we were trying to figure it out. The scientists weren't helping us figure it out. They were figuring out what breaks the community when something like this happens. And it turns out what breaks are the relationships of trust that we have with each other. And when that breaks, that's the glue that holds a civil society together. So when that breaks, you got to figure out how to reweave it. It's like our civil society tapestry just blew apart. And people wanted to work on the sobriety element. People wanted to work on the science element. And I invested myself in working on the economic diversification element because people were pretty desperate. People saw we had trees, let's clear cut. People saw we had coal, let's strip mine. We have, all this beautiful scenery, let's build a tourism port. And it's like, wait. If you strip mine and clear cut it, probably won't be so pretty. But nobody was thinking. Everybody was like totally desperate, okay? And into all that, I was looking ahead and I was looking, this is like 93, so now we're into 94, 95. Oh, and I forgot to say that the other half of the town said, no, we're here because we have Alaska Native folks who have lived there for 10,000 years. We don't live here because of clear cutting and strip mining, and the whole town went like this. And everybody was suing everybody. It's called a corrosive community. And I wrote a second book about this. I forgot my first book. But anyway, the second one is called Not One Drop, and it's about the emotional trauma. So it was in 1993 that the first Rio happened, and the President's Council on Sustainable Development was formed, and I knew that other states in the lower 48 were kind of looking at how to come up with this idea of jobs being more than just about money, but being about people's values as well. And I thought, well, maybe I could learn something real quick about that and bring that up. And to make a long story short, that's in effect what happened. And we came up with this exercise, and when I say we, I mean the community. Because we were all fighting, we decided to try to find what we liked, okay? As that was a little bit of common ground. So now we have this exercise it's a value-based community organizing, and we basically roll it from 10 o'clock in the morning till 4 o'clock. It's not what we're doing tomorrow. I'll bring this element in, but you basically get people, together, and that's a whole art. You want people of all the different philosophies. What do you like about your community? Give people 3 minutes to write on a piece of paper, and then go around the table and get everybody's ideas written down. Prioritize them, put them up on butcher paper. Pretty soon you've got the whole town's values out there. What are our top values? Second question. What do you want it is the community? I couldn't fit it in here. What do you want our community to look like in 20 years? Every person writes. All that's called social data. Do the same thing. You prioritize it. You get it up on paper. You get everybody to vote. You've got a priority. And then finally, what steps would you take to achieve that vision? And you get a prioritized list of action steps. And if you've done the job right and gotten enough of the different philosophies at the table at the same time, what you have is you have something that everybody's agreed to, and no one group will sabotage it because they see that there is a part of that solution that meets their needs as well. This is about meeting people's needs. And I had my 14-year-old goddaughter. I didn't realize my best friend, her mother, had pulled her daughter out of high school to attend this all-day community meeting. And Milani, I heard her at lunch, the lunch break, say, "I get it, Mom. This is like adult problem solving," which is, and this was way before the town meeting stuff. So we came up with, how many of you have heard of Copper River Salmon or Copper River Wild? Okay, so what do you know about it?
We got some better
very expensive, right? Okay, so when our Prince William Sound was what got oiled. The Copper River was much further to the east, and it was not oiled. When we lost our fisheries in Prince William Sound, the only fisheries we had left were the Copper River fishery. And we realized if that was going to support our town, we better figure out a way to get more money for it. So that was one of the things that we did. We niche marketed Copper River salmon. And I tell you what, to this day, the New York white linen and West Coast white linen tablecloths will send their own helicopters up. They will have charter planes. They will be at the guys' boats that are willing to do this. They will send the braille bag down. They will pick up the fish as they're harvested, take them back to the airport, and get them to the restaurants. This fish is, you know, it's like $21, $22 a pound retail, okay? But it supported our town until we started getting our legs back under us in Prince William Sound, with the pink salmon at least. So that was part of this. Now, this value-based organizing is a really critical thing, because it turns out that people share a lot of values. And we don't really go around talking about that. And we were shocked in our community when we found out that we shared so much. Because we thought, you know, the Democrats, the Republicans, like that, right? Well, imagine our surprise. So before I give you examples, because I do this with fifth grade all the way up now to enter the university. So why don't we just take a second and tell me what, just spit it out. We'll go through like five people. What do you like about your community? Shout it out. Diversity, all kinds of people from all over the world. Okay? Our riverfront, the marina. And are you saying the shops? Are you saying the environment? Are you saying it all? Okay, the beauty. The beauty of the riverfront. Okay. No, I'm just trying to make sure I'm hearing you exactly right. You can like the boats too. I'm just wondering. Okay, so natural beauty of the riverfront. Yes. Non-elitism. Friendly people and, okay, approachable. The dunes, okay.
I don't hear well, so some of them may have already said it, but one of the things that I value, particularly in the community, is that it has a kind of an indefeatable spirit. It has gone through the total collapse of the steel industry and the evacuation of the area, but the community stayed. Hard process.
Did you all hear him? So the gentleman suggested that he loves that this town has gone through really hard times and people don't leave. They love this area. They love this place. It's their home, and they figure out how to make it work. And that's pretty much what we did in Cordova, right? So, okay, so hold those five thoughts, okay? And I'm going to share with you. I have little kids do this, fifth graders. This is from California, all right? They get to write on butcher paper. They only have 3 minutes. What do they like? Best friends, my mommy and daddy, my home, my cat or dog or animals, ocean, mountains, water, surfboard, snowboard, skateboard, depending on what part of the country I'm in, peace and candy. Okay? So think about, and I'm going to spare you, I'm doing a workshop tomorrow, and I'm going to go into all this a little bit more depth. I call this my teaser talk, okay? But think about this in terms of what you heard people say, all right? Because as I tell the kids, all right, candy, that has a sticker on it. You go to the store, you buy it, right? Get all these little kids going, yeah. I say, so do your best friends have a sticker that says how much they're worth? No, you know? Do your mommy and daddy? Yes. So here's what we did in Cordova. This is what I do all everywhere, is we had this whole stack of data. We said, what do? We said, well, let's see where the similarities are. So these are actual types of wealth that we as people value. Environmental wealth. Now, what did we hear about the riverfront, the dunes, okay? Economic wealth. We figured it out. We made it stay. I'm assuming you figured out new and different economies, okay? Social wealth, we stayed because we like our town, okay? We stay because we like the diversity. That's social wealth. You're not putting a dollar value on that. You're just saying it's a cool thing as a human. And political wealth is something relatively new that as Citizens United comes down and people, and I'll talk about that. It's a lawsuit that gave corporations unlimited spending in election. People are realizing that our very rights are getting endangered. Our First Amendment right. People are not feeling secure in our democracy anymore. So when I first started doing this exercise, I've been on the road 11 years basically now. The last, since 2008, the most frequently. I mean, it's pretty much on the road. This political wealth is coming more up and more and more. And people are expressing it as, well, I'm not going to tell you because we might have some people tomorrow that, mum's the word. We're going to see what everybody says tomorrow. So when I explain this to kids, I go, okay, so surfboard or snowboard or skateboard, that costs money. Kids get that. But why do you do it? Why do you save your money to go buy a surfboard or a... Well, because we like to do that. Well, can you put a dollar value on that? Oh, no. So a lot of these things start blending, right? So a surfboard actually means you like to go hang with your buddies and you like the act of surfing. You're going to surf in a polluted area? No. So you're out there for nature too, right? So there's a whole discussion that can happen here about how our values are like intertwined. Political wealth is... It comes, we're going to get a little bit into the democracy, but it comes with the local democracy and the local people's ability to protect what they love. So if you have a place that you like to go fishing along the riverfront, okay, I know this because you only can eat so many fish a week, a month, or whatever if you're pregnant. I mean, if you had your druthers, you'd be eating more fish, right? So we need the political wealth to be able to protect what we love. We need a functioning democracy. Okay? So a lot of topics there, but all right. And when a society reflects human rights and human values, then we have our environmental wealth balanced with our social wealth and our economic wealth and the political wealth. And I don't know if you've heard of triple bottom line accounting. The universities always have to academic this and put in big words. But basically what it means is what we figured out in Cordova. We were scratching our heads what to do, and here we're just, nobody had figured this out. We were actually in a textbook for figuring this out. We were like, we want to diversify our economy. Our fishing's gone. What do we do? And we figured out that we liked all these different types of wealth. And somebody said, well, you know, why couldn't we bring in businesses that build one or more forms of our wealth, that don't destroy any? Can we bring in businesses that increase at least one form and don't decrease the other two? And people all said, you know, that makes sense. So let's think about this. What does clear cutting do? Well, it increases the economic wealth for until the trees are gone. But it really wreaks havoc on the environment. How could we do that differently? We came up with certified sustainable forestry. We came up with fishing, niche marketing our fish. We came up with ecotourism. Small niche marketing, send these big cruise ships. Let's bring in the small mom and pop operators. So we figured it out. We figured it out. And now, like I said, this when you say quality of life, I never really thought of what I meant by quality of life before, but really what it means is it's a quality that all the values that I love, they're protected. They're part of my life. And what authors are calling this now is a living economy. This is how we get to sustainability, by balancing these different forms of wealth and not trashing one for the advantage of others. So let's look at how we measure well-being or wellness in our country currently. It's pretty much only looking at economic wealth, okay? So it's looking at money exchanging hands, no values attached. It's called the gross domestic product, which I think in this case is very appropriate, gross. And it grows bigger and bigger the more social wealth and environmental wealth it consumes. And so what am I talking about here? The same authors call this a suicide economy. What I'm saying is it's great in this economy. If you're sick, the sicker the better. If you've got cancer, even better. Because you're paying money to your physicians, you're paying money for all these drugs, you're paying money for hospitals and whatnot. That is money into the economy. That is a good thing, the current way we measure wealth. All right? So the more unsafe your community is, the more locks you need for the door. Well, you got to buy those locks. You got to pay taxes for police to... So it's we are basically measuring sickness rather than well-being, okay? And I want to get into some of this tomorrow. I'm going to stop right there. And just say that our economy, I believe, when I say our economy, I mean the economy. You know, you always hear, well, it's about the economy. It reflects a sovereignty crisis because we already saw what people value. And our the economy only values economic wealth. Let me see what happened here. And really what we're talking about is it's corporate values. Because of corporations, they're fine as a business model. I have no argument with that. What I'm going to be talking about from now on is an imbalance with who is in charge of our democracy. Okay, and I'm going to argue that I think we have an imbalance now where our business model has taken over, and it's going to run us into trouble because it's only concerned about money. We have our values, other values, that are important to us. And so listen to how many values. I'm going to play a little clip of a young First Nation woman from British Columbia. British Columbia is very attuned to the Exxon Valdez oil spill. They are fighting a tar sands pipeline and tankers coming to the west from the Alberta tar sands. They actually got physically oiled from the Exxon Valdez. I didn't know that. I've been working with British Columbia First Nations people and others for about 11 years now. And this woman is now 13 years old. She wrote this song, and it's about the I'm running into children like this all around the country, okay? Yeah. And when people ask me, what do I do when I get depressed and feel like I'm up against some giant thing, I say I go and teach fifth graders. And what I want to share with you is that I ran into three of the chiefs from British Columbia when I went down in the Gulf of Mexico. I ended up down there for a full year. It was hot, okay? I didn't think I was going to be down there that long. And the chiefs knew I was down there. I tried to make it back at the end of May. I went. They knew I was coming back through. They said, "Tell us the story. Come. We're having a summit with 35 different clans, tribes in British Columbia. Come. We want you to come and share your story, what you saw. You know, these are storytelling people. These are oral tradition." So I did, but I didn't know what was going on. They were actually having a summit to decide what to do about the, I'm getting goosebumps, about the their equivalent of the Keystone XL. And those tribes all were getting together to birth a new clan called the Solidarity Clan. And I was one of two non-Indigenous folks birthed into that clan. And what we pledged was that we would do everything in our power to stop expansions of these pipelines. This is a dangerous, dirty energy. We can do much better than this. I can imagine our steel mills filled with making wind power, making other things. It's a job. Why can't we be doing jobs that give us life rather than give us death? So I believe my future is tied in with all of you and the decisions that you're making here, and it's tied in with all the other communities that are at risk from oil activities. So back to Cordova, just for a sec. Another problem that we started noticing as we stretched into our 17th year of our legal battle, Exxon had come to our community and said, "Trust us, we will make you whole. If your nets don't fill up with fish, bring in the proof and we will pay all reasonable claims." Reasonable being, we will go to court and fight you over what's reasonable. But we didn't know that, okay? And we also didn't know that marriages were going to break and that, you know, there would be all this violence. And that, of course, is priceless. So our native Iyak village native carved a shame pole. One had not been carved in over 200 years. Typically, they put the person who has offended the community at the top upside down as a token of shame. And then he sort of carved the story of the Exxon Valdez in 9 feet of yellow cedar. And in the middle of this pole, I don't show the whole thing, is the herring. The herring are the heart of Prince William Sound, and that was a hole. That was a hole. And rest in peace. We had over 6,000 people die before this lawsuit was over. No, nobody saw justice, basically. And when 20 years into this thing, when we lost and got paid 10 cents on the dollar, and I have friends who personally went bankrupt after 20 years of holding on and saying, "I'll pay that herring debt when I can't fish. I'll pay it. Here, you can have my second car. Here, you can have my child's college fund. I'm running out of things. Here, you can have my future claim in this lawsuit. You can have that." And it wasn't enough to cover people's debt. Okay? So what we did as a town when we got word of this was we painted the town. But we did it in banners like this. And people just expressed their opinion. And it gave us a way to talk to each other and feel that we weren't in this alone. We'd had enough people suicide at that point. So people were starting to ask, what happened here? This is America. How is Exxon able to manipulate our legal system, manipulate our political system, manipulate, you know, everything here? What happened? And I didn't know because I was a marine biologist, so I didn't pay attention to civics. So I went and kind of immersed myself in civics, all right? And we're going to go into this much more deeply tomorrow. Tomorrow we're going to talk about the evolution of corporate constitutional rights. This is a very shortened version of this. Anybody have a working definition of democracy? Demokratia? Any guesses? People in power, I heard. Is that?
Mob rule.
Mob rule. All right. Depending on your perspective, demos is the people. Kratia is power. So basically, we're talking about the people rule. We chose republic. But what I'm going to be talking about now when I say democracy, I'm talking about little d democracy, okay? People, government of, for, and by the people. And as we all know, the idea was a sovereign self-governance where we have three branches of government. The legislature makes law, judiciary interprets the law, the executive branch enforces the law, and they're all supposed to be held in checks and balances. Through, you know, you read the Constitution, you see this system. But the ultimate authority in our sovereign self-government is still, to this day, we the people. So if one of these branches of government goes wrong and the other two don't correct it, it's up to us. It's our democracy. Government of, for, and by the people. So the way this looks in our Constitution and Bill of Rights is that we have we the people. And this horizontal line is the difference between sovereign and the government that we have by our operates by our consent. Okay? So on the upper side of that line, we have we the people, we have rights. People have rights. We are sovereign, which means we're supposed to be in charge, and we operate in the private sphere and are within bounds of the laws. Okay? The government is accountable to us, we the people. It's supposed to be public, it's supposed to be transparent, and it's tasked with duties that we the people assign it through our elected representatives, through laws and implementing those laws. All right, back when our country got started, corporations existed. There were 20 transnational, they were big, corporations like East India Tea Company, you know, Hudson Bay Company. These were transnationals. And the question was what to do with them in this schematic of our government. So corporations got put on the government side where we want them to be held accountable to us. We want them to have duties. We want them to be transparent. And there was one more little problem that all our original laws in this country said a person shall, because there weren't very many corporations. We operated as businesses. And the early corporate lawyers said, well, hang on. We're not persons, so we don't have to obey the laws. And so for the purpose of the laws, corporations became known as artificial persons as opposed to living, breathing human beings, natural persons. Now, how many times does our Constitution use the word corporation? Trick question. Zero, right? And it uses the word person. Uh-oh. I have to look at my Constitution again. I actually read it on a plane and was tagging it all. I think it's 46. But the point is, it doesn't differentiate between an artificial person and a natural person. It just says person. And that is the wedge that has been exploited for the past 200 plus years that we're going to talk about tomorrow. And I'm going to share with you that the birth of corporate constitutional rights was not Citizens United in 2010. It was actually 1886. Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad, when the Supreme Court decided that a corporate person was equal to a human person and that what corporate persons were entitled to constitutional rights. This is the Supreme Court. Does this sound anything like how we're supposed to amend our Constitution? No. Okay. This is in the court of law. And so I use the little emblem now where we have our corporate person sort of on a soapbox waving a flag saying, I have my 14th Amendment right, and I am can usurp rights intended for humans. So basically what the Supreme Court did with this ruling was that overnight it reallocated power. And it took corporate person, because now they're equal to us, and it elevated them up into our sovereign, private, we the people. The problem is the laws in our country work to protect us from a tyranny of a centralized government, or they're supposed to, okay? So they work sort of vertically, not horizontally. We're supposed to be all equal, right? Well, I'm sorry, I don't have $40 billion or whatever these big corporations are making. So it's not working. This is one of the reasons. It turns out our founders didn't actually see this maybe coming, but there's two ways to recognize rights. One is people made law through Congress, the way we have spelled out in the Constitution. The other is judge made law through the judiciary branch. And basically, we've done the people made law 27 times, and the judges have done the corporate persons hundreds of times. Hundreds. We're going to go over maybe two dozen or so key cases that gave away, constantly eroded our power, we the real people. So basically, this is an imbalance now. And I want to emphasize that every time I say the word corporation, this is a business model. I don't have any problem with that. I have a problem with this imbalance. Okay, it disabled the democracy. It disabled all three branches of our democracy by having so much money pour down into influence. And this is ruled by judicial fiat. Okay, it is really not democracy. And, you know, when democracy is for sale, it's really not a democracy anymore. So we have the best democracy money can buy. And we realized this in Cordova. I do all my test lectures, or I used to, in Cordova first. So the town was always the first to know what, you know, what this. They ask the questions. I go find the answers. I share what I find. That's it, right? So we started asking who's next. We did this, of course, the day that the case came down, because we realized if the democracy wasn't treating us fairly, it wasn't going to treat any other little community fairly either, or big community. It wasn't, you know, so who's next? And we now know it's basically everyone, right? So let me jump really quickly here to some everyone's, okay? No sooner had our case in Alaska settled, and we were totally, you know, 10 cents on the dollar, I almost said a bad word, then literally the BP well blows in the Gulf. And I went, oh my God, everybody down there is going to make the same mistake we did. Trust us, we'll make you whole. Liars, 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 right? But, and then I realized, wait, unless somebody goes and coaches them. And then I was like, oh, that would be me. So I went down. And what you see here is, unfortunately, the burning going on. And it's the visible, remember I talked about soot and ultrafine particles and PAHs, that's what you're seeing going up into the air. And then, of course, the dispersants laid down on the ocean surface, and it was like spraying those mosquitoes with DDT. It wasn't just the mosquitoes that were dying, right? So the whole ocean mass comes up in the air, dispersants, the oil, the PAHs, and it went ashore. And I spent a year going back and forth along that coastline, community after community, repeating them. And there are sick children and sick people up and down that coastline. And I'm not talking a few. I am talking the entire population, I believe, was at risk of oil overexposure to this. And I heard respiratory symptoms. I heard this is a hair loss from the dispersant, dries up the sebaceous glands. I mean, you know, one older fellow said, well, I lost my hair too. I said, I think it's more convincing on a six-year-old, okay? These horrific nosebleeds. It turns out now the medical community, what are the top four, you know, characteristic symptoms of an oil exposure? Respiratory problems, central nervous system problems, dizziness, headache, nausea, seizures. And I have a horrible little film clip to show you that I was, anyway, we'll get to it. And these central nervous system, skin and blood problems, lesions, rashes, and bleeding, bleeding, bleeding. And that's what I saw for a whole year. And of course, how many of you heard there's been health problems in the Gulf from people? Yeah. Okay, so it just hasn't really come out that much. It's been squashed. And I think that this could be a turning point in our energy future choices, because it was a turning point in the civil rights movement. When the nation saw kids being bowled over by fire hoses, everybody went, whoa, whoa, what are we talking about here? This is a moral and ethical issue. Maybe I should weigh in on this. And the abolitionist, you know, the civil rights movement came through partially. So what I'm thinking here is with oil, this again is a civil, it's a social movement. It's about making the, weighing the public health risks, weighing the environmental risks, in balance with the jobs, and saying maybe we can do a little bit better. Maybe we start look at other energy choices. But people don't know about this. So I'm kind of looking at reframing the climate debate on public health. I came to Kalamazoo, Michigan a year after the tar sand spill there, because I was already in the Gulf and I was working with communities. I saw respirators on, I didn't see them, actually. People showed me pictures of the state and federal people who were monitoring air quality, respirators. But the workers who were up to their chest in this stuff, no respirators. We wear respirators in Alaska now. The guys are all trained with hazardous waste operations to protect their health. Didn't see it in the happening in the BP disaster either. Didn't see it happening when I went to Mayflower, Arkansas after the Exxon Pegasus tar sand spill there. And the other crazy thing that happened in Mayflower was that the street, Exxon evacuated people in houses on both sides of the street, but there's houses here that are facing these streets. They share a backyard. They're all breathing the same air. Exxon didn't bother these folks. I went, and when I roared around the neighborhoods, and everybody was exactly equally sick, Kids at the school were sick, but it was no physical oil. That's the way Exxon played it. Tar sands, fracking, I'm hearing the exact same symptoms overall, all right? Respiratory problems, central nervous system problems, skin problems, blood problems. And the thing is, I started thinking about it, and these tar sands oil, okay, it's crude oil, but it's very, very heavy oil. It's concentrated in the stuff that's really bad for you. It's concentrated in these polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. It also is thinned with a diluent, and the diluent is very much like dispersants in that it dissolves the oil. It also acts as an oil delivery mechanism, pulling this oil across our skin into our bodies. So what the studies that are coming out of the Gulf now, 3-4 years later, are finding that oil plus dispersant combined is way worse than oil alone to everything from bacteria to coral to little fish to dolphins, birds, up to people. All right, it's even the studies on people are starting to come out. So what I'm saying is with tar sands, you've already got this stuff pre-mixed. All right, you've got the solvent, the industrial solvent, mixed with the oil. With fracking, they send the industrial solvent down to dissolve the oil from the Bakken shale. So that's what's adding to the volatility of it. So we have this stuff running through our neighborhoods now in increasing amounts. Now, this is what I can't show until I get hooked. Does anybody know if the Wi-Fi is locked here? Here, I'll give it a shot, okay? Let me just see. Right. I'll do this at a break. I'll load it up. This is a 6-minute film clip of what's happening in the Gulf with kids and people. I'm just going to skip it for now. So we have been in our nation in this dilemma before, where our oceans were being plundered, our fields were, ravaged, and we actually have a list of grievances in our Declaration of Independence. These lists of grievances are exactly quoted from our Declaration of Independence right now, okay? This is what we the people, the ultimate power, are supposed to do when things go wrong. So here's the list of grievances. When our government, okay, we kept saying he in the Declaration of Independence because it kept referring to the king, okay? So when our government combines with others to subject us to a jurisdiction foreign to our Constitution and unacknowledged by our laws, we did not authorize corporations. Fundamentally altering the forms of our government, which I'm going to talk more about tomorrow. Plundered our seas, ravaged our lands, poisoned our waters, and destroyed the lives of our people. This is a great-grandmother in Texas trying to stop eminent domain seizure by TransCanada to build the tar sands pipeline across her property. A great-grandmother, for God's sakes. And by the way, this is my little claim to fame. I designed and sewed that giant ass. It was part of Bill Moyer's backbone campaign. Each cheek is 7 feet across, okay? Okay. This is how we fight, right? We fight with humor. We fight with creativity. We fight because we love where we are. All right, back to plundering our seas. When a long train of abuses and usurpations evinces a design to reduce the people under absolute plutocracy, I would argue oligarchy here, right? It is our right, it is our duty to throw off such government. Well, that sounds pretty hairy. How do we do that? Well, we do that the way we've done it before. We do it community by community. We get enough communities doing this. We get the regions doing this. So I co-founded a group called Move to Amend, which is about amending our U.S. Constitution. Corporations are not persons. Money is not speech. This is what happened on December 6th with one of the students, Daniel Lee, you'll see him, well, 6 months after I gave a talk about this. This is Los Angeles City Council. Oh, this is not Los Angeles. This is Los Angeles taking a vote.
Why are we here today? Why are we all filling the chambers?
Corporations are not people. Money is not free speech.
Corporations will not breathe. Corporations will not have children.
Corporations do pretend to be people for the same reason that the wolf dresses up as a sheep.
Corporations are not human beings. But we are in this condition because we have failed to act as human beings.
An affirmative vote today will make Los Angeles the first major city in the United States to call for a constitutional amendment to ensure that only human beings, not corporations, are endowed with constitutional rights.
We are willing to do the work that it's going to take to amend our Constitution to clearly establish that only human beings are entitled to constitutional rights.
Politicians of all stripes are going to have to make a choice where they're going to stand. Are you going to be with us, or are you going to be a shell for corporate personhood?
That's what the vote.
Every struggle to amend the Constitution began as just a group of regular Americans who wanted to end slavery, who thought that women should vote. These are how American amendments move forward.
Los Angeles became the first major U.S. city to call for a constitutional amendment reserving constitutional rights solely for living human beings. And the mayor of Los Angeles happened to be the mayor of the president of this Council of Mayors. And by 6 months later, in June of 2012, 1,000 cities had taken this pledge as well. That's how we move this forward. And believe it or not, such action is civil disobedience. Why? Because the Supreme Court says that corporations are persons. All right? So we have. This is what I'm going to be talking a little bit about tomorrow, about this notion of civil disobedience being like locked in front of things. It doesn't have to be like that. It can be simply doing something like this, okay? And when I talk to the fifth graders who haven't even had civics yet and ask them, what do we do with a broken law? And we've already talked about laws. I call any law broken that does not fundamentally reserve the power of, for, and by the people, all right? If it takes away human rights, so the laws that kept 3/5 of a person, remember that one in the Constitution? Broken. Slavery, broken. Laws that kept women from voting, broken. What do we do to fix that? Oh, the little kids think and they think and they think, and finally they say, we have to break it? And that's the exact answer. We have to break it. We have to pass a better law. And if enough of us do this, that will become the law and will replace the broken laws, okay? So we know what we want, and I've been all across. People get it in their heads. And I've decided that democracy is never really, you never get there, okay? It's a journey. You're always tinkering at it, making it better, right? And so we have to stand up. If we want this, I'll never forget the first time I was, you know, reading books, Thomas Paine, and I got to Give Me Liberty, or Patrick Henry, Give Me Liberty or Give Me Death. And I got goosebumps because I all of a sudden realized I know how he felt. Okay? So this is about changing the status quo. Not doing anything more than that. We're changing the status quo. These are about the things that prop up the status quo. Fossil fuel industry, cheap fossil fuels. We've changed energy sources before. Centralized banking, privatization. These are all things that do not really match our values. Privatization of what? Privatization of jails, privatization of water, privatization of public assets, like water, privatization of schools. I mean, you do a lot, okay? Corporate persons are sort of overconsumption. We don't have 5 planets to live on if we all tried to live like we in the U.S. I'm not saying different quality of life. I'm saying there's a vision out there that we can create that we will actually be thriving. A little different, but it will be better, okay? And the military-industrial complex, I have met students across America that are very impassioned about GMO foods or about healthcare or about water or about something, right? I'm passionate about energy. If enough people pull on follow their passion, tackle the issues, try to improve their area, the old will fall, but we better be ready to replace it with what we want, all right? And so what we're replacing it with is growing now in leaps and fits around the country. And I'll, you know, Yes Magazine, there's all tons of resources out there. But generally what we're trying to do is strengthen our democratic control over our public assets, public trust, the ecological commons, and our markets, our economy. And we're getting near the end here. I think this is about the power of story. So this is using our power. using what the gifts that we have as individuals, bringing them collectively together and joining forces. And this is Wangari Mathaya.
Problems that we face, and sometimes we can get completely overwhelmed. The story of the hummingbird is about this huge forest being consumed by a fire. All the animals in the forest come up and they are transfixed as they watch the forest burning, and they feel very overwhelmed, very powerless, except this little hummingbird. It says, I'm going to do something about the fire. So it flies to the nearest stream, takes a drop of water, and puts it on the fire, and goes up and down, up and down, up and down, as fast as it can. In the meantime, all the other animals, much bigger animals, like the elephant with a big trunk to bring much more water, they are standing there helpless. What do you think you can do? You're too little. This fire is too big. Your wings are too little. And you're big, so small. You can only bring a small drop of water at a time. But as they continue to discourage it, it turns to them without wasting any time and tells them, I'm doing the best I can. And that, to me, is what all of us should do. We should always feel like a hummingbird. I may feel insignificant, but I certainly don't want to be like the animals watching as the planet goes down the drain. I will be a hummingbird. I will do the best I can.
And so that's my main message, is that we are all far, far, far more powerful than we think we are. And we need, and I'm talking every age. I mean, so I encourage you to all to be like the hummingbird, and let's figure out where we can work together. One of the reasons I specifically came now is because of the BP Whiting refinery spill, which was a little spill, all right? Well, guess what? In Alaska, the month before the Exxon Valdez, we had a little spill that was insignificant. And it got away from the oil industry because they didn't have the booms and they didn't have the equipment. And the state said, oh, it was only a little spill. Don't get excited over a little spill. 1 month later, 30 million gallons. And they couldn't respond to it either. So this sets precedent. And it's important to hold the government accountable to the people. It's important to hold the industry accountable to the government, all right? And we're trying to work. I listened to what folks have suggested, and we're trying to come up with a plan on where to move forward with your little spill so that you won't have a big spill, okay? So thank you all very much.